Welcome back to the show. I'm Maya Schwader. It's so close you can practically smell it. A bill to legalize recreational weed in Connecticut is back before the legislature. And with Governor Lamont's support, it could become law as soon as this week. But this all could have happened much sooner. Later in the show, we'll talk to Connecticut State Representative Vincent Candelora about why last week he threatened to filibuster this bill, whose passage now seems all but inevitable, and the concerns that he still has about it.
I'm Derek Kennedy. And as Massachusetts rolls up its sleeves to blaze a trail of best practices around the business and economics of its already legalized marijuana industry, the Joint Committee on Cannabis Policy held a hearing today for six bills on the social equity agenda. Public testimonies were heard from two guests on our show today. The first, Shigun Itowu, president and CEO of BECMA, the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. He urged lawmakers to be fair in considering exactly who receives funding for this new profitable juggernaut. Mr. Itowu joins us now. Shigun, just tell me, what was your purpose for speaking to the Joint Committee on Cannabis Policy today?
Well, I appreciate this opportunity. You know, we at the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts, or BECMA, we represent the 2,000 Black firms that employ 17,000 Mass residents and generate $1.9 billion in revenue every year. And so for us, it is important that we are establishing equity in every industry in Massachusetts, cannabis included. So we were there today to share the thoughts of our members and our community to ensure that the equity that they voted to make possible is actually enacted by the legislature.
In your testimony, you spoke of new barriers that have hit the communities of color since COVID. How do any of the six bills that are on the social equity agenda help to rectify those issues?
Well, you know, our businesses, our entrepreneurs are facing barriers to entry long before COVID hit us. You know, the number one issue that you'll hear from any entrepreneur, any business owner, was access to capital. And as an organization, we don't talk much about access to capital. We talk about the dispersal of capital. We know where the money resides. We know our businesses are in a place and our ideas are great enough to be able to receive the funding. It's just that it's not given to us. It's not awarded to us for many reasons, all tied to this history of systemic racism and discrimination. And so many of the bills before the committee today focused on the creation of a trust fund or a social equity fund that would help to invest in Black and brown entrepreneurs. Our purpose for being there was to ensure that equity was more than a word, but a practice throughout this new industry. And so, you know, COVID has certainly ravaged our businesses, but when it comes to cannabis, our entrepreneurs, our business owners had access to little, if any, capital. They still had to pay rent. They still had to pay fees. And so our purpose, again, was to ensure that we were removing any barriers in accessing capital and making sure that they have access to all the resources they need to thrive across the Commonwealth.
How is cannabis going to help catapult small businesses coming out of the pandemic? Black and brown businesses.
Well, this is an entirely new industry. I mean, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to ensure that equity exists at the beginning of the process rather than 50 years from now when we're bemoaning the fact that a term that we've heard in Massachusetts all too common and all too frequently now, less than 1% of us are participating. You know, there are so many Black and brown people who have a stain on their legal record because the nation decided to criminalize a substance that we had no problem with 100 years ago. But as soon as our community started to deal with it, it became an illegal substance. And since then, many of our family members, community members, friends have been churned through this system of mass incarceration that is plaguing our community to this day, not just in inside the system, but also creating this wave of impact on everything else that people do when they return to our communities. We know that Black and brown businesses help to stabilize our economy. A study that came out last year showed that our businesses helped to add almost 2 million jobs to the national economy after the Great Recession, and white businesses lost 2.4 million jobs. So we know that we are vital to not only growing the economy of our communities, but the entire Commonwealth, the entire nation. So, you know, being able to participate in the cannabis industry is vital to not just the Black economy, but the economy of the entire Commonwealth.
So a bill like S-73, which is one of the six bills on the agenda for the committee, is an act relative to the expungement of convictions for marijuana possession. How do you flush through that to make sure that people are actually expunged of convictions that happened prior to cannabis becoming legal?
I try to make sense of it all to understand why it takes so long to do the right thing. People should not have been criminalized, or this industry should not have been criminalized to begin with, and therefore we should not have been criminalized as a result of participating. That being said, if we are going to say, if the voters of Massachusetts are going to say, we are going to reverse that decision and ensure that recreational cannabis is allowed and medicinal marijuana is allowed, you have to atone for what has happened. And people's lives, whole families, have been destroyed by the system of mass incarceration, the failed war on drugs. And so when it comes to expungement, we cannot on one hand say, okay, we made a mistake, let's legalize this and set up a whole new system of profit. And then on the other hand, say the people who suffered as a result of that mistake still have to live with that scarlet letter. So for us as an organization, it makes entire sense to remove a stain that should not have been there to begin with, to ensure that the barriers tied to that to that stain don't follow you for the rest of your life. I mean, at the end of the day, if you've served a sentence in prison, the theory is that if you return to society, it means that you have atoned for the crime that the society says that you've committed and that everything should come back to normal. But really what happens is when you return to society, we never let you forget and we don't forget. And we, you know, bar you from certain housing. We ensure that you are working in jobs that are at poverty wages. We ensure that you have to be reliant on the system for the rest of your life. And it's why we see a high rate of recidivism and other issues that are plaguing our community. And so at the end of the day, expungement makes the most sense to us too. It's another barrier to participation. And again, if we as a state want to claim that we are progressive, that we're liberal, we have to be so in more than name only. We need to atone for the mistakes that were made. And that includes not only removing the barriers to access to capital and other things that exist, but also that initial barrier of having that that scarlet letter following you around everywhere you go. So expungement makes the most sense to us if we really want to create equity in this industry.
That was Segun Idigu, president and CEO of BECMA, the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. Thank you so much for joining us on And Another Thing.
Thank you for having me.
As we've heard, Massachusetts is contemplating the serious social questions that come with legalizing cannabis, questions that every state will eventually have to answer. Because, as our next guest points out, every state legalizing is more or less inevitable. It just makes economic sense. Jay Rosenthal is the president of Business of Cannabis, an industry publication based in Canada. He's a native of Natick and has kept close tabs on legalization in New England. And he said that for a state like, say, Connecticut, which is wedged between two other states with very legal weed, there is a huge economic incentive for the bridge state to follow suit.
It's a lot about tax dollars, first and foremost. We've seen in other places where you are the state that either is the one state that has legal cannabis or the one in the middle of other states, and you lose significant tax revenue. And while Massachusetts and New York stand to gain significant tax revenue if Connecticut doesn't do it. But in terms of what it would mean for Connecticut, Marijuana Business Daily, sort of the leading publication in the sector, estimates that adult use recreational cannabis 4 years from legalization could be as much as $725 million in revenue. So it's not insignificant. And that's already on top of what will be over a $200 million medical cannabis program in Connecticut. So it's not insignificant. And then you sort of layer in the percentages on top of that, that would be tax base. And it's significant money that either could flow into Connecticut coffers or out of Connecticut into those other states. And that is a real reality. And not only that, I mean, I think more than that, if you had said to any legislator in the General Assembly, you have a chance to create a near $1 billion industry within 4 years, and the tax revenue associated with that, which is actually above and beyond what most things get taxed at, what do you say? And I think most of them would say yes. Maybe even especially some of the people that may vote no. Whereas you look at the Northeast and especially New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Vermont, you know, in the New England states, the rest of the New England states, people live within driving distance of the other. And you ask, I would even say liquor stores on the border of New Hampshire and Massachusetts, like how big a driver is for people to drive into New Hampshire and buy at a state liquor store, it's considerable. People will change behavior based on where it's legal, where it's not. And we've seen that in other places. That's sort of the logistics of living in sort of confined states that are close together and people travel for work and other reasons. And it's not as if people in Connecticut aren't consuming cannabis now, right? This is the other paradox, is that the policy that is in place now just does not work. It doesn't work to keep cannabis out of the hands of kids. It doesn't work to, it's an unregulated industry basically, and everything that comes along with it. But by regulating it, making it heavily regulated and taxing it and being competitive with your neighboring states and what they're doing, you know, the arguments add up quickly. And is it a snowball effect? Yes, but it's also the historical arc is bending towards legalization. And whether it passes this week or next year or the year after, this is coming. And not to say like it or not, here it is. This is because the policy has failed and adults can enjoy cannabis and governments and industry can reap the benefit of that.
Why now, though? This has been a political fight for decades. What is it about the present moment that says that this is impending, whether you like it or not?
Yeah, I think the war specifically against cannabis seems sillier and sillier as we go. One, because states have done it and the sky just does not fall. Countries have done it and the sky does not fall. We see that I'm based in Toronto. The sky does not fall. Kids have actually less access to cannabis when you legalize. States, cities, countries have more access to tax dollars when you legalize. And the sort of haphazard way that the United States has gone about it has created a very strange industry where everybody operates within the borders of a state. But even the conversation at the federal level has progressed so rapidly that this is going to happen, and it's going to happen quickly because people don't see a reason why it shouldn't happen. And the current policy just plainly doesn't work. Cannabis is ubiquitous. And if you don't believe me or don't believe you or don't believe other people on the show, go to a high school in Connecticut and ask them how easy it is to get cannabis. And then go ask them how easy it is to get beer. And you will see it's probably easier to get cannabis because it's unregulated and it's literally everywhere.
Do you find it a little bit ironic that as it's being legalized, a lot of the people who are coming into the legal industry tend to be white as opposed to the Black and brown communities who were traditionally the stewards of the illegal industry?
I don't know if it's ironic. I think it's unsettling. And I think states, this is also what's happening later versus earlier in legalization. States are trying to do more and more to head that off. The challenge is states make it a really heavily regulated industry. The barrier to entry is extremely high, because capital and regulations are hard to put together. So it inevitably leads to like revert to who has resources or access to capital. And that tends to be entrenched interests everywhere. It's also hard, regardless of like, to get someone to give up their business in an unregulated way to enter a regulated framework. You know, it's business is good on the unregulated side. I don't know how else to say that. Like it really is good. Like it's a cash business. And there's a willing market and it's an entrenched consumer base. It's hard. That says nothing to the people that have been incarcerated now or in the past that should have their records expunged for something that's about to be legal. That's absolutely needs to be part of the conversation too.
That was Jay Rosenthal, a weed industry analyst and the president of Business of Cannabis. You are listening to And Another Thing on New England Public Media.
You're listening to New England Public Media. President Biden has called on lowering Medicare eligibility from 65 to 60, and some say that could save lives. Coming up on Marketplace, we'll take a look at the political hurdles in the case to expand Medicare. Marketplace is coming up at 6:30, followed by Fresh Air at 7 and Jazz Alamode at 8 on New England Public Media and on your smart speaker. And Another Thing on New England Public Media is funded by you. By Summerlin Floors, a certified woman-owned business with a variety of flooring options and specializing in green flooring alternatives, summerlinfloors.com. And by Dean's Beans Organic Coffee, creators and funders of the Kids Stimulus Package, a school feeding program for children throughout Western Massachusetts. DeansBeans.com. This is New England Public Media.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Dara Kennedy. We continue our discussion on the legalization of marijuana in our region. Cannabis has made millennials millionaires at the fastest rate. According to Grandview Research Firm, the 2021 recreational and medical weed industry was valued at $33 billion. However, data also shows that while the business is booming, it is extremely difficult for people of color and LGBTQ individuals to break into. A Marijuana Business Daily survey revealed that a whopping over 80% of cannabis owners and founders were white. And that's why Devin Alexander, a millennial from Quincy, Massachusetts, spoke at the cannabis social equity hearings today.
Yeah, so we're going to open a marijuana delivery operator license that is going to be located down in Middleborough, Massachusetts. We have obtained our host community agreement. We have done our community outreach meeting, obtained our multiple letters of good standing, and all the other requirements needed to obtain provisional licensure. They just released the applications for this new license type roughly 2.5 weeks ago. So we just applied for it. Delivery, there's two parts to it. There's a part called pre-certification, which is basically the equivalent of getting pre-approved for a mortgage. So you send in multiple SOPs, your business plan, your plan to obtain general liability insurance. And then they sign off on that. And then that allows you to go on to the next phase of the application, which is the provisional application. So we just actually got back our application today. They sent us an RFI, which is stands for Request for Information. So they just wanted to see a couple of tweaks to our SOPs until they can deem our pre-certification complete. So we're still in the seed round of fundraising. Obviously, because cannabis is a federally legal business, we're not able to obtain traditional bank loans like most other small startups can. So that's why I found it was crucial today to testify in support of Social Equity Trust Fund so we can gain access to these no-interest loans and grants, because it'll go a long way. So if we had an investment in the six-figure range from the state, that would be a good building block for us to gain more and go through the multiple levels of fundraising. Marijuana was legalized roughly about 5 years ago in the Commonwealth, and people are getting arrested every day still for cannabis. So it's great to see programs like this in the state, but they still have a long way to go to really reach the goals that they're trying to reach.
That was Devin Alexander, owner of Rolling Relief, a startup cannabis delivery company.
Financial equity and innovation in the weed space might be next on the to-do list for Connecticut. As soon as this week, there could be a budding growth industry in legal cannabis in the Bridge State. And actually, the legislature looked poised to pass this legalization bill last week, and then one man stepped in. State Representative Vincent Candelora is the Connecticut House Minority Leader. He tells us he threatened to filibuster the bill because he was afraid there was corruption baked into it.
I have never been supportive of the commercialization of marijuana. And so I've always had concerns. But when the bill came out, there was a provision in it that provided a benefit for one individual in the state of Connecticut to jump the line, get a permit, and begin growing. And so that raised serious concerns for me that there was some sort of quid pro quo or corruption that was going on behind the bill. And so that sort of stalled out the progress of it moving forward. Obviously, the other problem was it was up against the deadline of 12 midnight where we had to get all our business done. And so it wasn't even a threat of a filibuster. It was just the fact that there was no way we were going to accomplish all of our legislative work and get this bill passed. So early on, I suggested, let's do a reset. Let's look at this bill because it came out on Sunday. It needed the light of day. Let's talk about it and vote on it in special session.
Are you satisfied now?
So overall, I think the process is better. You know, there's some changes that were incorporated into the bill at the suggestion of Republicans. I still do have some concerns with the bill. I think the labor pieces that are in it are frankly preempted by federal law. So very soon, once this law gets passed, we're going to be in litigation. We're the only state in the country that's done that. I don't like the fees in the bill. I think they're too high. The medical patients, I think, should have a waiver. I don't think they should have to pay for medical cards anymore. And then overall, I'm concerned with the THC levels, with the gummies and the products, the baked goods. I'd rather see those not put into the commercial market, but leave that in the medical arena. So if people want those kind of products, they can do it by going into the medical arena as opposed to the commercialized market, which is naturally going to impact our children.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. You're saying impacting the children, trying to put some limits on the market here. Massachusetts has had this system for a little while where there are gummies and there are edibles around. Do you anticipate that Connecticut is going to be able to handle doing the same thing?
I think it's a mistake. So if you look at Colorado, who's had this program for 10 years, they're actually now starting to roll back because they're recognizing that it's too much. So actually their legislature just passed a proposal that is going to limit the THC limits. They're proposing to go down to 30, potentially as low as 30 THC levels. So I think we should be following what Colorado is doing because they've been the longest in and recognizing that we need to tamp it down. Just having teenage children in my household, the amount of exposure they've had to marijuana and the amount of products is pretty alarming for high school kids. So I would just like to see that we, if we're going to market this, let's keep it at sort of the Vermont model. Let's allow for homegrown. Let's allow a retail market, but keep the retail market tamped down to like a 30% THC level and leave all of the other products in the medical field. So I think the bill is going to pass, but I don't think the current structure of this bill, we're going to see it soon, because I think it's going to fall very quickly into litigation because of those pieces that were preempted. So I think the state could do a better job of crafting this bill. And my guess is we're going to be in next session fixing all the mistakes that are put into this bill. And once those get fixed, then maybe Connecticut will see it. But I think we're a couple of years away.
Connecticut has had decriminalized marijuana as well as medical marijuana for around a decade now. Talk us through a little bit of the politics behind the scene. Why is it that now this bill suddenly seems viable despite what you've laid out?
Yeah, I think there's a real push on the social equity piece. So we hear a lot about how our Black and brown communities have been impacted by the war on drugs over the last couple of decades. And so that push is really driving the legalization piece because it's providing a revenue stream that's going to go into reinvesting in these neighborhoods. And that is a driver. That is something that's attracted to people. And I think it's moved some of our members who represent cities to support the bill when you're seeing at the same time a lot of our clergy in the cities are opposing the bill because they're concerned of the impacts on kids. So I think there's a happy medium that we might be able to achieve. And so I think that this is the beginning of a long conversation with legalization in Connecticut. And I think when we talk about the social equity piece in the bill, what it's doing is segregating money into a fund to allow for commercial investment for minority-owned companies. So it's almost sort of like a small business express program where loans will go out to help businesses become developed. The other controversial piece of this is people don't feel there's enough going toward substance abuse, drug abuse treatment, you know, mental health. So that's the other piece that there's still struggle over is, yes, we have a social equity component, but we need to pay attention to the public health component.
Representative Vincent Candelora is the House Minority Leader in Connecticut.